Tahira has seen and talked with angels and her spirit guide for as long as she... Angel mystic Atira was born with an amazing gift. Atira has seen and talked with angels and her spirit guide for as long as she can remember. And now she connects you with spirit as the angels answer your questions on past lives, passed over loved ones, dreams, relatives, workplace, and spiritual experiences. Atira is an Edgar Cayce Foundation handpicked psychic and is featured in The Days of Wonder by G.W. Hardin. Atira's magical, uplifting, worldwide readings are just $100 for 45 minutes, which includes an audio tape. Email angelreadings@angelscribe.com. That's angelreadings@angelscribe.com for an appointment, or go to Atira's website at angelscribe.com. For metaphysical, straight talk from the heart, it's Atira, Angel Mystic.
Other side, like, what will it be like when we pass? Well, today we're going to get some really amazing answers and have a great discussion. Today's guest is Kimberly Clark Sharp, and she has been billed as the near-death comedian. And she is the founder or the head of the Near-Death Experience Foundation here in Seattle. She has a background in social work, a master's degree in social work from the University of Washington. She is a pioneer in the field of critical care social work. She is also been she's a clinical associate professor at the University of Washington for over 21 years. And she was named one of the 40 most interesting people in the Northwest, and I believe that because I've got to have really great personal conversations with her. If you will please welcome to the show Kimberly Clark Sharp. Hello, Kimberly.
Oh, thank you, ladies and germs. And now can I be the rudest radio guest ever and correct some things?
Sure. I've stumbled over it. I apologize. I did reread it before I came on the air, but
no, I struggled with
the print. I'm sorry.
No. It's just I was a clinical assistant professor. Get up to associate, but anyone
dyslexic will read things.
Could care less. I mean, so just a little.
No, that's okay. Correct me because a dyslexic will read it wrong every time.
Yeah, it's they're all hard-earned achievements. That assistant professor, and the other thing is, it wasn't.
I got to tell you, though, I got to be honest with you. Assistants, we usually work harder than the bosses anyway, so we'll understand that.
Oh, and it's assistant to nothing. It doesn't mean you assist anybody. It's just that the ranks are...
I know, the academic level.
It's the academic level, yeah. No, I need
What's important, though, is you do know about near-death experiences. That I got right.
Yeah, you got right, and I was laughing at the comedian thing because, I'm just a social worker, but it turns out I'm funny.
You are funny.
In an area where people are usually really scared. So, but the one thing I was really laughing at is that it wasn't that I was named one of the most interesting people in the Pacific Northwest.
Influential. But, I think you're interesting. I'm sorry. I would make that Freudian slip.
No, I would actually just, I think it sounds more interesting than influential because that sounds like, boy, I really do know a lot of stuff. But as it turns out, I really do know a lot of stuff.
I've been
in this field since 1975, so cough, cough, do the math. And in that amount of time, not only is the field of death and dying, emerged. It didn't even exist when I started out.
But, I really think you kind of, Kubler-Ross was doing her work.
It's weirder than that. In April of 1977, three things happened. Raymond Moody's book, Life After Life, the very first book on the subject of near-death experiences, hit big. That was in April of 77. In April of 77, a woman walked up to Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and said, I'm going to tell you a story about something that happened to my son, which was what we now call a near-death experience. And also in April of 77, I met a woman named Maria and reported what is now the most well-known out-of-body during a near-death experience story ever. And I'd love to tell you and your listeners, because
I'd love to hear it. Yeah.
Okay, this is by...
I just want to clarify something, because I thought Kubler-Ross was really the first, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross was really the first one to do on the phases of death, correct? Not necessarily near death.
Because
her book came out in 1976.
That's on death and dying. And she is actually Stages of Loss. And something
stages
she
of
deeply...
Grief, I guess.
Yeah, grief and loss, which includes one's own life. She regretted ever doing that, by the way, by the end of her days, because so many people, have then decided that they have expectations that they're actually sequential stages, and they're not. She called it more like fruitcake. You know, you slice a piece of fruitcake, and you get a little green stuff, a little red stuff, you know, you get it all. So, no, but she was already established in death and dying. It's just that... It was in April of 77 that someone came up to tell her a story about what we now call a near-death experience. And in the same month is the time I heard the story of the shoe on the ledge. And it's just weird in the universe that the same month of the same year, there were three of us being brought into the subject of near-death experiences. So, odd timing.
I think they call it synchronicity now.
Odd timing. No. Multisyllabic words. Oh, my.
Yes.
You know, it was synchronicity. Now we have, you know, the chance to reflect and know that we were being guided in the direction, well, that led me to the shoe on the ledge. So here's the story. And this is what got me into it. And if I could, like, toss in, I also wrote a book about all of this. And
we'll talk about that, and we'll give them the title and your web page and everything.
Yeah, for people who don't know that or aren't listening or want to share the story, it is in print in many forms, but The Horse's Mouth did come out in a book. But anyway, so I was a young social worker at Harborview Medical Center in Seattle, Washington, working on the intensive care unit. First time a social worker had been in that kind of a place, and me getting there was also full of synchronicities. And I'd had a near-death experience myself, May 25th, 1970, and in the 7 years that had passed, I had gotten my master's of social work and decided that I was crazy. I was doing my own diagnostics, and I was absolutely convinced I was a nutcase because there were no maps or references, there's no language, there was no information, to say the least, and it was like a wacky, wacky world after that. So I'm now a social worker at Harborview Medical Center, which, by the way, that facility, then as now, serves a landmass of one-fourth of the United States.
I know, it's really, for people
huge.
Who don't know, it's like the major trauma center. In really the Northwest. I mean, it's just huge, huge, huge.
It's huge, and the area it serves is multi-state.
And it's massive.
All right. So the point is that there are lots of people dying, so lots of, you know, lots of opportunities to help people. So, but one day a woman named Maria, who was Hispanic, originally from Mexico, primarily non-English speaking, and was living in the Yakima Valley area. Actually, she and her family and others were migrant workers, and they'd worked their way up from the southern boundaries of the United States to the northern as the prevailing crops allowed. But anyway, Maria came to the big city, 120 miles west of Yakima, which would be Seattle, Washington, and then had a huge heart attack, was brought into the coronary care unit, and because of her you know, all kinds of needs. She was an immediate priority on my caseload. So a few days after she was admitted and she was doing okay, I was in the chart room with some nurses, and that's also where the monitors for the coronary care unit were. And someone started to flatline, and it was Maria. So Harbor View is a University of Washington teaching facility, so you don't get a doctor, a nurse, and a respiratory therapist. You get the thundering herds, and probably any listeners seen that on TV by now. So as it turns out, there were 12 people doing her resuscitation, and I was like the baker's dozen, 13th at the doorway, watching a very easy resuscitation. Maria was brought back around. She was unconscious, breathing on her own. I left, went about my business of seeing other people. Then, later in the day, I got a call from the coronary care unit because Maria was conscious and extremely agitated. They were concerned that she would slip back into cardiac arrest, so as a social worker, would I go fix it? To make a four-hour...
Isn't it amazing how they think you can just fix it, though, too? That's a really interesting...
Oh, yeah, social workers listening know that drill.
Well, I think nurses, a lot of nurses and doctors and other trained professionals also do get that. You know, you walk in and they just want instant fix, so it's scary.
Yeah, and back then, I mean, how many years ago, there wasn't the death education out there.
Right.
In fact, I taught one of the nation's first classes to physicians on how to tell someone that they're dying, or how to tell loved ones that a death has occurred or is about to occur. So, and ironically, that was also in 1977. That was the nation's first death and dying class in a medical school, and there were a whole bunch of us teaching it, but it was heady times. But anyway, there was just no information, so fixing it meant, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
So,
and little did you know what it was going to mean, right?
Oh, I was walking into my destiny, and I had no idea. On every level, my destiny. And my greatest teacher remains this poor migrant Hispanic worker, because she got the ball rolling. But anyway, so I went in to see her. She was indeed very agitated. So, skipping through what I was about to say, 4 hours of process because of her language difficulties, and my Espanol is really bad. So we had this pidgin English, and anyway, what she wound up telling me is that during her resuscitation, and these are my words, not Maria's, she found herself first hovering in a corner, and she correctly identified who was in the room, what equipment was there. It was pretty impressive, but I didn't believe her because I had not dealt with my own near-death experience. Now I was hearing something really similar, and I just couldn't deal. So I decided that Maria could hear what was going on, and she was confabulating, not deliberately lying, but, you know, the brain was filling in spaces. And then she said she found herself just like a snap out above the emergency room door, and she could see that it was a one-way entry and that the doors automatically opened and closed. Again, I thought, well, she was admitted through the emergency room, so even though she was unconscious, her room was above the ER, and maybe someone from housekeeping had pushed her bed by the window, and she could observe all that. Now I was becoming more of a knucklehead than anything at this point because there is, in fact, a roof over the emergency room entrance because, hello, it rains in Seattle, and so any medical facility is going to have something to keep people from getting wet as they're loaded out of ambulances. So, but the corker was that she then, again, without any sense of moving, found herself on another part of the hospital, 3 or 4 stories above the ground, looking eyeball to shoelace with a tennis shoe. And the reason she was agitated is because she wanted someone to get the shoe. She was really excited about that. And she described it as large. It was for the left foot. It was dark blue. And in case I got it confused with any other tennis shoes out on any other ledge, there was a white lace that went under the heel and then disappeared from her perspective. So I went to look for the shoe. I walked around the building. I didn't see anything. And then I saw a bird fly in and land on a ledge And then I couldn't see the bird, so I thought, oh, great, I'm not going to be able to see this.
You're not going to be able to validate it.
Not from the ground. Mm-hmm. So I went into the building, and with a sigh of resignation, thought, okay, I'm going to have to just start going into people's rooms. And fortunately, many of them were my patients. And and then with my luck, of course, I started on the exact opposite side of the building. But I eventually made my way to a window where there was a dark blue left tennis shoe with, oh, and another feature she mentioned, I'm sorry, that the little toe was scruffed. I mean, she had so much detail. And there was the shoe as she described it. And Harborview was called such because, hello, there's this big view of Puget Sound, the harbor. And I looked out the window really for an answer, an explanation of some kind. And about a half a mile away or more was, at that time, a lone downtown high building. And I thought the only way she could have spotted the shoe is if she had somehow gained access to an upper floor of this building with binoculars or telescope, looked towards the hospital, saw a shoe on the ledge, remembered it in case she had a massive heart attack and was admitted to that healthcare facility where she could fool some social worker. That's the best I could do.
I mean, that you know, that, it's interesting how extreme we'll go to reason things out, though, isn't it?
Oh, my brain can go vast places in fear.
Yeah.
And I was afraid. I was, Atira, I'm not kidding, I was scared because I had had a similar experience in my own near-death experience. And because I had so neatly tied up my mental health package to high-functioning schizophrenic is what I decided.
Well, exactly. I think that's one thing I want to mention is because of your academic background, I just read a counseling book, and I have to tell you, if I'd have read it earlier, I would have known I was a paranoid schizophrenic because I do readings and hear voices. So for our listening audience, if you're from that field, you're so taught to put it in some kind of label or box.
Exactly.
And even in our normalness, we try to reason. So when you're done with this story, I really do want you to kind of give my listening audience just a breakdown of what the average stages of what people do when they have a near-death, because I think it's important to have the foundation.
Oh, sure. And this illustrates a good point about one of the most exciting aspects. So, well, and the end of the story is here. I could not come up with a rational explanation as to how a woman I observed flatlining was quite a ways from her physical body, flitting around, having a good time, and spotting this shoe. So it was my watershed moment. I now know what it feels like to not be able to maintain one's balance. It happens at the back of the knees. I felt like a flour sack had hit me. I went forward, bonked my head on the glass, looked down, and out loud said, "This happened to me." And I remember, you know, momentary fogging of the window. And to this day, it was my moment of, oh, my gosh. And everything galvanized for me. I thought, okay, there's two of us in the world, and I'm in a really good place to find others. And went back with the shoe and big reunion with Maria and the shoe, and it was the ultimate validation. And this is the one story that no skeptic worldwide has been able to puncture because it's just too validated. I mean,
well, and she didn't have time to call her nearest relative to go put a shoe on the fourth floor's ledge.
I hadn't even found a relative yet.
No, but I mean, you know what I mean. Everybody would try to debunk this in some way. So it's not
there is no way.
Enough time elapsed. You know, there's not other, you know, ways to debunk this. I mean,
there was none. Yeah, there's no way, and there's lots of cases since then that have come forward.
Absolutely.
That are just electrifying, but this was the first and the firmest.
Now, is this story in your book?
Yes, this is actually chapter one.
Good.
On the ledge. How direct.
Great opportunity for advertisement. The name of the book
is After the Light, and subtitle is depends on what publisher you're picking up because the book was hardback with one William Morrow and paperback with Avon, and it's an audio tape with HarperCollins, and now in any bookstore you could order, or library, or on the internet, and it's through iUniverse. But After the Light by Kimberly Clark Sharp, there's a couple of subtitles because there's been an update on the book, but After the Light will get you there. And I haven't really been funny during the show, but I did write about a lot of serious things with a lot of emotional impact, and the book's been out since 95, so I have a lot of experience with readers by now. And oh, and then I do have a brag, because it was the alternate book of the month for the Literary Guild of Canada, so even got awarded, and considering its subject matter, I thought that was huge.
But well, anyway, it is a great subject matter. I want to talk about that for a minute, because, you know, I started out when I first got into going towards ministry work was in a hospital as a, you know, working co with a hospital chaplain. So for me, that was the background of, oh, you know, it's really grief, death, dying, and all the associated things. And so when I can remember when I first read Moody's book on the near-death experience, I had already talked to a few people that had these near-death experiences. Like, what do I do with that? Where do I put it? Because, like you said, in the early years, there wasn't a lot out there. And so there's a huge need. But the fact that you went and started teaching how to deliver and how to deal with grief with doctors, I love you for that, Kimberly. Because I find that doctors really don't know how to say anything.
No, but that's because they're not taught. And there's two things that will bring someone immediately to a physician: death and sex. And physicians, because there's so much physiology they have to learn and more every day, you know, how many years can these people go to school? Sex and death education were simply not available until the late 70s for in any medical school. And now it's so much better because there's hospice. Thank you, Elizabeth Cooper Ross, again.
Yes.
And there's books and
well, and they're taught to, you know, they're taught to save lives. They don't know when God wins and people go home. They, you know, God got us all, it is whoever your deity is. But, you know, it's really hard for them because they see it as a failure. Dilusia? Oh, no. I hope we have not had technical difficulties, so I'm hoping that someone's listening and we'll get her back on the line. on the line. I have no idea, Seth, if we're on the air. I hope you're hearing the sound behind us. Kimberly, welcome back to the show. If there is electronics involved, I'm sure we always have something going on. Can you hear me, Kimberly?
Yes, I can.
Awesome. Back to you.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
All right, let me tell you, this is so full of symbolism. I'm just, like, cracking up. Because I, too, have that effect on just energy. But electronics is the most available, and I'm on a land phone plugged into the wall.
Me too.
And I thought, oh my gosh. So I was blaming myself.
No.
And then I could hear you, and I was about to make a point about the one measurable aspect of a near-death experience happens when people have out-of-body experiences, but they're out-of-body and they can't communicate to others around them, but they feel like they can. And so I'm going on about that. And you're going, Kimberly, Kimberly, we can't hear you. And I'm going, I'm here. I'm trying to tell you this.
So we mimicked a near-death experience.
We did. It was hysterical. I couldn't believe it. So I was making my own point, but no one could hear me.
Well, again, let's go over that because I think it's important. And I want to say the name of the book, After the Light, again. And do you have a web page? I did not see that.
Yes. The word Seattle, like the city of Seattle. Seattle, and then the letters I, A, N as in Nancy, D as in David, S as in sauerkraut, .org. So the whole thing is seattleions.org. IONS stands for the International Association for Near-Death Studies, and the Seattle, this is literally, and at IONS.org, people will find the universe on the subject of near-death experiences for 25 years and 18 days. I've been leading what is now the world's oldest and largest support group on the subject, which is in Seattle. We just had a big 25th anniversary gala like 2.5 weeks ago. So been doing this a long time, Matera, and yet I'm so young. No, I'm not. I'm just immature. So, but the one measurable aspect of a near-death experience would be the out-of-body experiences because people, especially when they're able to identify objects in remote places and come back and then those objects are found, what are you going to do? I mean, it's amazing. And just about 3 years ago, there was a woman in Atlanta having a brain surgery that was lasting hours and hours and hours. She came out of her body and identified an instrument that they used during the surgery. And what was astounding about that is that she correctly reported it to the neurosurgeon and to her cardiologist. The cardiologist had to go to the internet to look it up because he'd never heard of it. The neurosurgeon said, well, this is, she's telling the truth because, but I don't know how because not only were her eyes taped, but we had a shroud over her head so that only her skull was exposed. The instrument was in an opaque, sterile container, so it couldn't have been seen until he actually had it out in her brain. And at that time, they were flatlining her so that no blood would pulse. And so that, things like that are happening now and being recorded. And so out-of-body experiences are the most validating part of what we call a near-death experience, but the most heartfelt aspect of a near-death experience and absolutely the most common part of a near-death experience is reunions with deceased loved ones. And for that, we would need more time than we have. That could be a whole subject on a show, Atira. But about 75% of the people who report a near-death experience report these reunions. And, of course, they're wonderful. And they include, you know, extended family members, parents, deceased siblings, deceased children, babies who died at childbirth. I mean, it goes on and on and on. And I've crammed After the Light with these stories. After the Light is really just one big story because at the time, I was diagnosed with terminal cancer, And I thought, oh my gosh, I have too many stories in my head that will just rock the planet. So I wrote After the Light, and it was over 1,000 pages long, and my editor had a little issue with that. So
it's time for the second book.
Yeah. Oh, what? You've been talking to my agents?
No, I've been talking to Spirit.
Yes, actually, I'm simmering four of them, and something's got to break. One of them will come forth. There's just too much to tell. And by the way, I had 8 to 10 months to live, and I see my oncologist tomorrow, which means I'm still alive.
Mm-hmm. And congratulations. That's a, you know, for anybody who's had that diagnosis, it's a tunnel of terror for sure.
Oh, it sucks. It's not the diagnosis, and it's actually, I'm not afraid of death at all. It's the treatment.
Having been there.
The treatment is like,
yeah,
blah.
Let's
anyway.
Go back a little bit to the near-death experience, because I think people, you know, the story is amazing. The shoe story is absolutely phenomenally amazing. But I know that there's often many sort of experiences that happen within the experience. And so some people hear absolutely a quiet peace that they've never, ever could describe. Then other people hear a whooshing noise, which was funny because when we first came back, we had a whooshing noise on the air. It's going, okay, this is getting gear by the moment. Okay, good. And then dark tunnels. Some people go down a tunnel.
Yeah.
And some people just see a light and go towards the light. So there's sort of these classical things that are now being documented with
yeah.
the experience.
Oh, yeah, well documented, as a matter of fact. The whooshing noise is, I just simply, in my teaching and lectures, I call it the noise because, no, I don't. Someone took issue because it sounded grating. I now refer to it as the sound.
The sound. Okay.
And it goes from that wishing thing to angelic choirs, beyond beauty. There's, in fact, an architect who had an experience where he heard the most beautiful sounds ever within his near-death experience, and he owns property on the north end of Bainbridge Island off of Seattle and Puget Sound. So he built a two-story wind harp, which if you've got a boat, you can go out and see. A person can actually climb the base of this wind harp. He was trying to
recreate
the sounds he heard in heaven as the winds, you know, blow down from Straits of Juan de Fuca. But he said, no, even though it's a beautiful musical instrument, he said, no, it's not as beautiful. The light is the most, quote-unquote, spiritual aspect of a near-death experience. It's the whole aspect is called ineffable because there are no words for this conversation that we're having. But the light people refer to as God. I had that experience, so I say God or my creator, but you know, Terry, you could go Bubba if it were in a certain center of reference, because there's no words.
Right. Well, we don't
light.
Have. We really do not have a frame of reference.
Not going to happen.
Yeah.
The tunnel people go through generally head first. I've spoken with one woman who went in backwards, and I thought, thank you, lady, for sharing that, because now I have to mention you every time I speak on the subject.
One way to be immortal.
You haven't mentioned something that you and I are familiar with, and that is meeting one's spirit guides,
or
very sacred beings,
spiritual
being. Say Jesus.
You know, it's another interesting thing, because when we were talking before this, you asked me if I'd had a near-death experience, and I said, well, you know, in my work, being a clairvoyant psychic, there's one thing I've always noticed, because I've been at a lot of death scenes. And that is, I see the angelic realm line up in a certain way. In other words, I see people's guardian angels at the foot of their bed. There's a certain thing, a certain arrangement, let me sort of say, that I see as a clairvoyant. So, and it's consistent every time, although the angels may be different, or the spirit guides or the relatives are different, obviously. But where certain angels stand tell me who they are in relationship, or who the people often are in relationship to the person that's doing the passing. So that I thought was a very interesting aspect.
Back to After the Light. One of the, I came back with some wampum spiritual gifts.
Most people do.
My own near-death experience, and that included not clairvoyance, but actual discernment. So I was able until I was pregnant, of all things, towards my fifth month of my first pregnancy, I actually could see angels with my eyeballs.
That's what I see all the time.
Yeah, so it wasn't even like... But now, and also what we would call demons, what I'm comfortable calling negative energy, and so now I just sense things, and I know you do too, and together...
No, but I was
there's
really,
a lot of us out
I was,
there.
No, but I was really wondering, have any other clairvoyants mentioned that?
Near-death experiencers have.
Yeah.
But they wouldn't call themselves clairvoyant. But.
Right. Well, almost everybody I've ever talked to that's had this experience comes back being able to see differently.
Oh,
and they all
heightened awareness.
They all come back also with wanting to do something that affects the world. Or, in other words, they react and treat. The reactions to the world is different. They are permanently
right.
forever changed.
It's, and that's also going to be crazy-making because people want to come back and save the world. I'm actually giving a workshop in Beverly Hills in a bit on this very subject because people do generally want to come back and save the world, but in the balance, one has to still pay one's bills, know one's zip code, you know, and not be all acting crazy. We have to be grounded. It's very, very challenging. And
as long as you mentioned that workshop, let's mention the ARE workshop.
Yeah, actually, because that's the biggie. If for anyone listening in the Puget Sound area, most of my talks are out of this area or abroad, and the ARE and Atira, I'll let you do their commercial, but Atira and I are both attached at the hip to this organization?
We are attached to the... I'm attached to the ARE because, of course, Edgar Cayce was one of the first people I ever read a book about that was like me and made me feel like, oh, my God, I'm not alone. So every year, the ARE Association chapter here in Washington has some kind of conference, and they have it at CBAC. And so this year, we're blessed with having Kimberly Clark Sharp speak on near-death experience, and Vicki Warren is an internationally known psychic that is going to be the co-speaker there. It's a wonderful event, and you can go to www.edgarcayce.org, or you can also go to or call the local chapter, which the number looks like it is 425-681-0020. If you're interested in that conference. And it's right around the corner. It's July 4th through the 8th at CBEC. And it's a wonderful, wonderful place.
And it'll be intense because we're the only two speakers. We're just going. And
I know a lot of people that are going. It's very, very exciting. I have a commitment. Otherwise, I'd be there with bells on.
Oh, well, no, because that's where the bells are going to be. Yeah, it's going to be wonderful because CBEC itself is in this slice of paradise on the Washington State Peninsula. But mainly, it's since it's a retreat setting, it's this kind of information and more unfurled. And I can't wait, personally. It's just going to be awesome. So, and a nice long time to talk about these things. Which
that's it. In an hour show, you cannot possibly paint the whole canvas of this experience and be able to answer a lot of questions because we really even did not even open the phone lines, and I know they would be jammed, but I really wanted to get your knowledge rather than just, I know people are desperate to talk about this, especially if they've had it. So please know that you can go to her website, which she will give again, and also, you know, get the opportunity to go to CBEC because I really want her to have time to talk more about the actual experiences because they're just so...
Yeah, and that's...
The vast knowledge. There's just so much.
And to be honest, in 1995, someone was actually doing a nose count of people that I had interviewed face-to-face who had had near-death experiences, and it was during 1995 that the nose count reached 2,000. So... Stop counting after that, and that's not including phone calls, internet, letters, or
you know,
other people's stories.
I think also when Dr. Moody's book came out and when Danny and Brinkley went very public with his near-death experience, you know, it gave more, I mean, there's definitely obviously more out there in the book realm than certainly in 1995.
Well, let's talk Betty Eady, who's right out of Seattle Alliance. Mm-hmm. Betty Eady, who wrote the only best, you know, number one bestseller on the subject and really brought it into popular culture, was Betty Eady Housewife sitting in Seattle in our support group,
mm-hmm.
Which, by the way, is open to the public and is free. So, and between 50 and 100 people attend once a month on the first Saturday of every month. But if you go to the website, you'll see that. And if you're not in this area, you'll see what other groups just like that are. There's 44 groups just in this country alone.
44, angelic number.
Yay. So there's a whole bunch of resources out there for people. And also, certainly, people can get a hold of me. This is what I do. It's my day job. And
I want to talk about this, too, Kimberly, that it's very important to have a support group because, you know, people, first of all, having dying is traumatic enough, being that seriously ill,
right,
that some are in an accident or whatever that causes a near death is traumatic enough. But then to come back and have these things happen and not feel like you can tell anybody, you know, I mean, how can your blood pressure ever go down, you know? Unless you find other people who have had these experiences.
Yeah. And sadly, despite all of this time, all of the scientific information out there, on and on and on, it just breaks my heart when I hear from someone who's been hurt by the negative judgments of someone else towards their experience, be it a family member, a neighbor, a friend, a healthcare provider, whatever. In this day and age, there's no excuse, and yet there are people who act hurtfully towards people who, you know, forget the near-death experience, just having gone physically through what it takes to get that close to death.
Yeah. How do you feel that, like, the medical profession is are they getting more enlightened about these experiences?
I'm doing my best. That's my milieu, so... Yeah, the person who invented CPR as we know it,
mm-hmm,
was one of my bosses at Harborview Medical Center, is head of the cardiology department, Dr. Leonard Cobb. And back in the 70s, when I was going on about this, he said, "I'll give you a dime for every one of my patients who's had this kind of experience." And I brought up so many charts. It was ridiculous, and I never did get a dime out of him. And then he was being honored at a luncheon about 3 years ago, and I was there. And he came up like a child. He was so excited because he had interviewed his first patient himself that had this experience. And he took his hands and put them around my face. This guy's a legend. And he said, "Kim, you were right." And I thought, oh, my gosh, I can die now. It's like I'm done, but obviously I'm not. But... So the medical profession, those in the death and dying field cannot ignore it. So I think we're good for go there.
What I've actually noticed in the last few years is doctors are actually coming to me, which I never thought in my whole lifetime would ever happen.
Wow.
And
huge.
Asking me to go on rounds with them. The first time this particular doctor asked me if I would go on rounds, he said, I can't have you say anything to the patient, but would you go on rounds with me and you tell me what you see and what, you know, you think's wrong with these patients, and then I'd like us to consult together and just for my own experience to see, you know, what you do, because I know it's real, but I want to experience how would it affect my rounds if this happened. And I actually never really went on the rounds, but I did, you know, view a few patients, which was good. But it was interesting to me that finally someone was open enough. I said, boy, this is the next generation of doctor we want to see. And my niece happens to be an EMT. And we got in a discussion about this, and I said, you really need to read about these things, near-death experience, different things, because in that profession, guess what? You're going to see a lot of it. So don't think people are hallucinating necessarily when they come back. They may be. But what if they're not? What if they're just really trying to express, oh, my God, I saw something. You know, I was out of the body over the ambulance, blah, 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 blah. You know, Danny Brinkley describes his whole trip to the emergency.
Well, yeah, and I myself went back through the body of the person who was giving me CPR on a Kansas sidewalk in 1970. So, hello. Can you imagine how I lecture to physicians and to medical students? Oh, my gosh. Because I have the actual memory of you know, like out of Ghosts. So, yes.
But are you lecturing? Are you getting lectures like that? Are you getting the opportunities?
Oh, yeah. That's my, like I said, it's my day job. So I'm also well married. I married a man who, as it turns out, gets the credit for, I don't even know of a verb, but because he didn't invent CPR, I've already told you who did that. But my husband, Donald E. Sharp, is the person who worldwide gets credit for citizen CPR. And talk about a great life review. Oh, we didn't talk about life reviews. See, each of these elements could be a separate show, Atira. I'm not kidding. Oh, the life reviews. But anyway, he'll have a good one because he's gone around the world and helped whole nations facilitate the education of their populations so that anybody can do CPR. And so because of that, more and more people are having...
Well, people are being successfully resuscitated, right,
and they're
exactly.
back to talk about it.
Right.
And in Seattle, a successful resuscitation is defined by returning to one's previous lifestyle at work or at home.
Well, you know, let's talk about that for a minute. You know, truly, in not so long ago, and in many third and fourth world countries today, if you live to be 35-year-old.
Yeah.
So, you know, we have with the equipment, the medical knowledge, the all this stuff, the CPR, your wonderful husband, all of that has made it much more, the chances of you coming back if there's a massive heart attack or if there's something that happens, really, I'm sure is 10 times greater or much more even than that statistically.
Yeah, we don't know the numbers. Gallup, as in the Gallup poll, did the only national, again, the word nose count, of near-death experiencers. That was 20 years ago. And their figures were, I think, like 8-something million. If you project that forward without even factoring in, citizen CPR is up to like 13 million now. So in the city of Seattle, again, nods to my husband, but you can't even get out of middle school without knowing CPR. And 50% of the population know CPR. In L.A., it's 3%. In San Francisco, it's 3%. In New York, it's less than 3%. So,
right. Well, and now everybody will be moving to Seattle. Now look what you've done.
It was a good place to get health care. But the main thing that anyone can do to help a near-death experiencer or themselves or someone, even if they don't remember what happened, is to learn CPR. There's no reason to not. It's easy. And in the synchronicities, there's that word again, of everything. I've twice had to give CPR, and once in O'Hare Airport and once in Evanston, Illinois. That was just 2 years ago at a near-death conference at Northwestern University.
Wow.
And I did CPR on a woman who choked on food at a pub across from the conference hotel. So,
back
you know,
near-death, though.
Huh?
Because back to near death.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Are we on that? Oh, yes.
That's
hello.
Okay.
Hi.
That's okay.
My name's Kimberly.
I want to talk about the life review because we have to, you know, 5-2, we go off the air, so I want to make sure we have 5 minutes to talk about the life review because I really think that's part of what really profoundly changes people.
Yes, and there are two kinds of life review. Again, I invite people to get after the light or borrow it or go to the library, ask about it, whatever. Because that's where the stories are. It's the most story-filled book that so far has been published. And the life review, though, in summation, comes in two, like, flavors. One is an observance of all the elements of one's life in various forms, sometimes in flashes, sometimes in, like, a little movie, sometimes forward, sometimes backwards. Then there's another kind of life review where people are actually put in to the perspectives of everyone they've crossed paths with in deed, in words, and hello, in thought. So even our thoughts about people will revisit us. It's a huge responsibility. It's so huge, it make you crazy. So I just tell people, you know, if you live an authentic life, you'll be okay. Just live authentically and be nice to others. I didn't have a life preview, though. I had a life. I didn't have a life review. I had a life preview, and among other things, I even saw like portraits of people that were total strangers and they had labels under their name that were very casual, like next door neighbor, colleague, blah blah blah. And I have now in 37 years met all but one.
You know, that's fascinating to have that projected forward because, you know, I was just actually interviewing somebody and talking about past lives. And this lady says, yeah, I've done past life regressions, but I've also done forward. And I thought, oh, I wouldn't have thought of that. So really, you actually saw where your life would be leading you. And how did you at the time really get how profound? Once you had the remembrance of and that, you know, this was your path, did you get how profound this was?
Not even slightly. I was raised, to be honest, to tell you the truth, I was raised in great material comfort. My dad, who's recently deceased, actually, was the head of a law firm that still represents all the tobacco companies in the United States and Canada. So talk about the original insider. And I was used to receiving any kind of service I wanted. I mean, I had what I called, in After the Light, I said, think a pony, get a pony, and it was like that.
Mm.
And I saw myself, in addition to the portraits, I saw myself living in a place where all I could remember was where mountains met water, but it turned out to be Seattle.
Mm.
And I also saw myself being of service. And after an astonishing hour and a half of resuscitation, by the way, by a number of healthcare providers, the PC resistance on my really prolonged near-death experience, which is chapter two in the book, was seeing a life of service. And I said something like, to God's light, like, cool, and I was back. So it's been a hard knock life at Tira. I'm not going to kid anybody about that. A life of service is...
But that's what we really
all
came
that.
To do. Really, truly, all of us, really, it's about coming to be service. I hate this. Time is up. Give your website again, please, please, so that people can find you.
Yes. The word Seattle, and then all run together, Seattle, and the initials I-A-N, as in near-death experience, D, as in death, S, as in service. So SeattleIONS.org.
And you're going to be at the ARRE and see back
in July. Days and days and days of Kim. And I haven't been funny during this time. I really am funny. I'm being billed as a near-death comedian.
But you can go to www.edgarcasey.org and you can find out that this is going on because I know they have links there.
Yes.
And please make sure you look for her book, After the Light, by Kimberly Clark Sharp. And I'm sure we'll have you back because we haven't even touched the tip of the iceberg.
No, and because of global warming, it's melting.
Yes.
Ba-dum! I finally got a joke out. Yay!
And because of technical difficulties so that we can talk about the experience of out-of-body.
I'm going to be lecturing on this experience.
So,
God bless you, Atira.
Thank you so much.
And God bless all your listeners.
Thank you so much for being here. We'll have you back after you get back from all these conferences and your worldwide tour, I'm sure, with the next four books. Thank you so much for enlightening us and helping us understand this experience, because really, truly, many, many people are having this experience now.
Yeah, well, thank you.
Okay, blessings, darling.
All right.
And remember to let your heart light shine to light your way and the way for others. And till we talk again, stay wrapped in the wings of angels.